Fall in love with your user's problem, not your solution. A lot of us just naturally, you know, I'm an idea person, so I always have ideas like, oh my gosh, it would be so cool to build this or to build that. And I think that's very natural to have ideas. Maybe the reason I like it is that it's something I have to remind myself constantly, which is like, that's a nice idea or solution, but like, what problem is it solving?
How do you get yourself to stop with the ideas?
Yeah, it's very difficult, right? And to use sort of a morbid phrase, it's like, how do you, people say sometimes you have to like kill your darlings, and it's just very, very hard to do. I think one thing that helps, again, is to, before starting to implement something, really talk in detail about what you expect to happen. Right. And so, again, going back to the experimentation thing, it's like when scientists like are running an experiment or you're testing a drug or something, you have like a really clear hypothesis. And like, this is what we think will happen or what should happen. Right. And so then if it doesn't happen, it's really clear that it didn't work, quote unquote.
How might someone who is non-technical be able to set themselves apart or be able to land, you know, PM jobs right now? Or do you think, you know, AI is now acting as a kind of leveler for, you know, technical, non-technical folks, and that doesn't matter that much?
So no, I don't think that AI is acting as a complete leveler. So what I believe AI, some of the sort of vibe coding tools let you do today is prototype. So if you are somebody who has high agency and you're like, I can just build something with AI and then I can launch it and see how many users I get, I think that's really great.
Hey there, and welcome to the first ever episode of The Craft. I'm Emmy, and I'm the creator and host. My goal for this podcast is to learn from senior professionals about the mindsets, mental models, and systems that shape how they work and lead. Our crafter for today is Okpe Bukola. Okpe is an educational technology executive with over a decade of experience building products that expand access to knowledge and economic opportunity. From 2020 to 2024, she founded and led Kibo School, an online university that provided an accredited computer science degree to African students. Previously, she led the product team for Google Classroom, driving its growth to over 40 million monthly active users globally. She has also held product and partnership roles at Amplify Education and CK12 Foundation. Okpe serves on the board of Zeta Charter Schools and advises 3MTT, the Federal Government of Nigeria initiative to bolster technical talents and jobs. Today, we talked about her lessons from working at Amplify and Google, some of Okpe's product philosophies, how to test ideas, run experiments, and define success, and knowing when to kill your darlings. The vision behind Kibo, Okpe's most recent company, skills and mindsets that junior professionals need to ramp up in their career and work today. As you go through the episode, please drop comments to let me know what you think, like, and would love to see more of. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider following or subscribing wherever you are listening from. Drop a rating and share with a professional in your network who might benefit from the conversation. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy. But you've had, you know, what many, at least myself, would consider a great career trajectory. So from NYU to Amplify Education, then to Google, you found your own companies, and you're now sort of advising organizations like Zeta, 3MTT, which for those listening, that's 3 million tech talents. And with all of these, there's a common thread, which is around education. Why education? Did you always know you wanted to work in this space?
Yes. I have always been interested in education, partly because I've always loved learning. So when I was younger, I really enjoyed school. I really liked my teachers. So I've always thought of education as something interesting to be a part of, though not necessarily a career path. When I was in university, I studied economics and math. I was more interested then in economic development, and in particular in the development of African countries. But one of the things I did at the same time as I went through university is I continued teaching. So I was a tutor, a private math tutor, but I also did a lot of volunteer tutoring and teaching, ended up becoming close friends with a lot of people who were interested in education from a policy perspective. So I knew that I was interested in it. I didn't necessarily want to be a classroom teacher. One of the things that happened for me, however, is like right around when I was leaving university, there were a lot of really interesting new ed tech tools that came up. You know, Khan Academy launched, MIT launched something called OpenCourseWare, where they were putting a lot of their materials online for the first time, you know, long before like Coursera or any of those platforms. And for me, it was really interesting because it was a glimpse into the possibility for people anywhere in the world to get access to education as long as they had the internet. So it connected to my interest in economic development and how do we help African countries develop, plus education, plus technology. So I knew that I wanted to work at that intersection eventually, and tech just became the thing that helped me bridge the gap between like really caring about how do we help nations prosper, which is really about helping individuals prosper, and then, you know, how do we educate people. So tech sort of brought it together, and I've pretty much been working on it my entire career.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I guess now you've worked as product managers for, you know, these products and working directly with education. Did you always figure that it was products that you were going to do? I mean, I imagine that you are able to still work or build things for education outside of products. But yeah, did you always decide, okay, now that I know I like education, I would love to work in product management so I'm able to build for education directly? Or was that something that just came up?
Yeah, for me, it came up along the way. So I did not know that product management was like a career path or a possibility. It's very different today because PMs are quite well known. But in 2005, like unless you were in San Francisco at very few companies, you know, I think this was like just after Facebook launch, right? So we're very, very early. That was just not a career that people really knew of. The way I came to understand what product management was I was working for a company in, I think it was around 2010, that built open source textbooks. And my role was really around partnerships and working with, at the time, charter schools to help them pilot and test out these new digital textbooks that teachers could edit and were available open source and free. And in that role, I had a lot of interaction with the users. I had a lot of feedback from users. I had really strong opinions about how the product ought to work. And that was when I kind of discovered, oh, there is actually a job that puts you at the intersection of what's really good for your users, how you build a good business or, you know, nonprofit or venture. And then what is technically feasible. So I came to discover product management, and it's just turned out to be a really good fit for me.
Mm-hmm. And figuring out product management and exactly what the core of the role is, you've worked at both Amplify and Google, as we mentioned, as a PM. And I imagine the core idea around building products is, you know, the same, building products that users need. But I'm curious, how were the cultures different at, you know, Amplify versus Google? With Google, I imagine, you know, you're building for a much larger scale. You're building with really smart people like yourself. But how were the cultures different in these places?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll share and then I'll caveat and say like it was a long time ago. So my time at Amplify was over a decade ago at this point, and Google is coming up along the same. So it's been a while since I was at these companies. So I don't want to suggest that like this is what they're like right now. But in general, you know, Amplify, when I worked there, was relatively small. I don't remember how many, but probably maybe low thousands or hundreds of people. They were also building products that were sold to school districts. And so I think as a PM, some of the core things are the same. You really want to deeply understand your user needs, figure out how you translate that need into good technology, work with an engineering team to deliver that. But one thing that was just different culturally is the sales cycle was a much bigger part of the product management role at Amplify, because we had these big sales that we were looking to make, and they were really like the buyers were a really, really important stakeholder, even though they weren't necessarily the end users of the product. At Google, we had a much more consumer focused lens, where the way that I was there at the really early days of Google Classroom, I think Google Classroom has grown really massive and it's maybe a bit more centralized than it used to be. But back then it was really just like a teacher or a school might decide to use it. And so it was much more around like going directly to those consumers, in these cases, teachers, understanding their needs, getting them to drive adoption. And so in general, it wasn't exactly this, but it felt a bit more like B2B versus B2C culturally in terms of how you think about how you plan the product, how you launch, how you iterate. So that was one big difference in culture. And then, you know, they're just always difference in cultures from company at different companies, right? Depending on what the companies are like. But I think those are less interesting or are less generally applicable than some of those B2B versus B2C dynamics.
Yeah, you've talked a bit about, you know, your, I guess, product philosophy, where it's understanding the user and, you know, solving for that. You have a, I don't know whether to describe this as a favorite PM motto that I've heard, that is fall in love with your user's problem, not your solution. I've heard about it a couple of times. Can you tell us a bit about this quote? It's a little self-explanatory, but what does it mean to you? Is there a story behind it somewhere?
Sure. Fall in love with your user's problem, not your solution. There isn't really a story behind it. I do say that a lot when I'm in product roles, and it's a truism. I think I say it a lot because it's really hard for people to implement. A lot of us just naturally, you know, I'm an idea person, so I always have ideas like, oh my gosh, it would be so cool to build this or to build that. And I think that's very natural to have ideas. But once you have ideas, the human nature drives us to love our ideas. And so it's one of those things, maybe the reason I like it is that it's something I have to remind myself constantly, which is like, that's a nice idea or solution, but like, what problem is it solving? In general, whether you're building software products or not, like an organization or a marketing initiative, like whatever it is that you're doing, I think asking that question of like, what problem is this solving is really important. Like, what problem is it solving for the person who's going to use it? What problem is it solving for my business? And so having like a problem focused lens, I think really helps you deliver things that are actually valuable. And today, you know, it's 2025. And I think because of the technology that we have available and like the continued interest in like Gen AI and just all these new possibilities that are opening up, more and more people are falling in love with their solutions versus users' problems. And so I see a lot of tools. I'm like, yeah, that seems interesting, but like, who is it for? Like, why does that person care? Like, what is that person trying to do? Like, at the end of the day, regardless of what methodology you use to deliver your solution, whether it's like traditional software, whether it's Gen AI, whether it's like not software related at all, it has to solve a problem for someone for it to be valuable.
Solving a problem for someone for it to be valuable, I think that's something that's profound. And I have sort of a connecting question to this, which is, in addition to, you know, this quote and how you think about it, are there any other, I guess, frameworks or mechanisms that has helped you, you know, I don't know whether pressure test is the right word here, but test the quality of your ideas before building them or as you build them? Are there any other, you know, frameworks that you use to say, okay, this is the right thing or this is not the right thing?
So starting with the problem and thinking through like the problem you're trying to solve is a really important one. Another sort of methodology that I subscribe to is just starting small and thinking about experiments. It can be really difficult when you're building a new product or you have a big vision to go straight to that vision and thinking about like, what is the small piece of this that I can execute? It's a little bit of, you know, the MVP or the minimum lovable product, like whatever you want to call it. But I tend to think more in terms of experiments and bets, which is like, what is the experiment that I'm going to run? And, you know, if we think about the scientific method, like when you have an experiment, you usually have a hypothesis, like this is what I believe will happen. This is why I believe that thing will happen. And then I will run the experiment and I'll evaluate. And so taking like an experiment driven approach to product development, I think is really valuable because it forces you to test like small pieces of your idea. And ultimately what experiments let you do is to gather more data about the problem. So it relates back to falling in love with the user's problem. But if you can be running small experiments with your user before you launch the big thing, you end up learning a lot. When we were building Kibo, which, you know, we started out with this vision for, we want to do an online computer science program for young Africans. We didn't just work towards that and launch a bachelor's degree, right? We launched these like short courses that were initially 2 weeks and 3 weeks and 4 weeks. But those experiments allowed us to learn a lot and figure things out. Like the ultimate solution was still what we imagined when we started. But there's a ton of nuance and details that are hard to learn without actually just doing. So taking an experiment-driven approach is another methodology that I think is really valuable.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. And that resonates a lot. I know during my time at Kibo, and we'll talk about Kibo later on this on board. I know that during my time at Kibo, you had really emphasized the importance of running little experiments to be able to sort of gather feedback and learn as we go. Still in the same line of, I guess, testing the ideas and knowing what works versus what doesn't. Were there moments in your career where you've built something only to realize, oh, this wasn't right? Maybe you're using some of the, you know, methodologies that you've already shared, but are there things or stories around things that you built where, you know, later on you found out, okay, maybe this wasn't the right thing, or maybe I should solve for something else before this thing? Is there any story you can share?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm thinking of specific stories. You know, honestly, I think that sort of thing happens all the time. And so they don't loom very largely in my head, just because it's a pretty natural part of developing like any product or any solution. Even with something like Kibo, when we started, the vision was like a really like completely virtual experience. And we learned really quickly, hey, that's actually not going to work because of infrastructure challenges. And so we need to think about these co-learning spaces as part of the solution. So that's maybe one thing that didn't work. I've been fortunate enough that, and some of it is a mindset thing, like I sort of expect a lot of things to fail. So the things that don't work, I don't even like spend a ton of time thinking about the stories. Well, because for me, they're part of the experiment, right? It's like you sort of, you know, I used to say this a lot, is like you are iterating your way towards greatness. And so part of the like small failures is how you get going on the longer term cycle of whatever it is that you're building.
And how, I guess, so this is the question I didn't plan for. How do you get yourself to stop with the ideas? So like you mentioned initially, we all have ideas and, you know, big ideas around what our solution should be. How do you get yourself to, I guess, not connect to emotionally and be able to recognize and say, you know, let's pause on this thing. This is not working as we intended.
Yeah, it's very difficult, right? I think it's like, you know, to use sort of a morbid phrase, it's like, people say sometimes you have to like kill your darlings, and it's just very, very hard to do. I think one thing that helps, again, is to, before starting to implement something, really talk in detail about what you expect to happen. Right. And so, again, going back to the experimentation thing, it's like when scientists like are running an experiment or you're testing a drug or something, you have like a really clear hypothesis and like this is what we think will happen or what should happen. Right. And so then if it doesn't happen, it's really clear that it didn't work, quote unquote. I think people often, though, we don't set up that initially. Like we don't say, okay, this is what we believe and why, and kind of hold ourselves accountable to it. I think if you as an individual or as a team, you write up like, okay, these are our goals, these are our hypotheses, this is the definition of success before you even start the thing, then after the thing has happened, it's a lot harder for you to kind of pretend it's successful, right? So an example is like if I'm working on a new product and I do like a 1 month experiment to launch it and I say, okay, we're going to sell 50 units and 80% of the people have to say that they would refer a friend, right? Those are our two success metrics. And then I go through this process and 3 months later, we actually sold 30 and only 50%. Then it's like, wait, but this didn't actually work, right? We didn't meet our goals, versus if I didn't have those goals, like those metrics, because I've worked on it, I've invested time, energy, like we're not good at sunk cost as humans. It would be very easy to be like, oh, but I sold 30. That's good, right? 50% referred. That's good. But it's like, okay, but that is actually not what you said what would make this like a success, quote unquote. So one way that I try to guard against that for myself is to set up the definition of success before I start doing something, because I know that I'm going to like backwards justify it otherwise. And I think a lot of us are that way. So having those criteria is helpful. And then something else, if you want to go one step further, is to even have kill criteria, right? Before you start something, meaning if it doesn't meet this bar, I'm going to stop, right? So write down like what is the kill criteria and then hold yourself accountable to the kill criteria. I see that in a lot of large enterprises where they'll launch something and then it actually isn't going that well. It's not like, you know, nobody's using it, but it's like quite unsuccessful. But because they didn't have the kill criteria, then it's like now you have to hurt someone's feelings to say that we should shut down this project. You know, like it all gets harder and harder. But if everybody was involved before anything happened, and even the project owner was part of setting that kill criteria, it's a lot easier to kill it. And then the last thing I'll say is, so, you know, having success metrics, having kill criteria, I think the third thing is more of just a sort of individual and organizational mindset, which is trying to create a mindset of we try and we're going to fail, like a mindset that makes failure acceptable and not hugely detrimental, that doesn't overly punish individuals for failure. Because if you are in an environment that punishes things not working out, you're going to be incentivized to make everything, to keep going no matter what. And then if you're the kind of individual that like really punishes yourself internally when things don't work out, you're also not going to be really good at being like, okay, I should just stop and choose a different path.
So the core ideas are having success, I guess you can call it success criterias and kill criterias, and being able to hold yourself accountable to those, and, you know, more as a personal or individual and organizational mindset around making failure acceptable. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, there's a book. Sorry, I just said one more thing. There's a book that I really love that I recommend to people all the time about this. It's a book called Quit. It's by a woman, Annie Duke, who's a great thinker and also was a professional poker player, but just like really helps you think about frameworks for when you should stop doing things. And that book was really helpful for me at a time when I needed it. And I just think it's good for all people to think about, okay, sometimes you got to stop doing things. And
Yeah, thank you. Quit by Annie Duke. I'll link that in the show notes for everyone listening. So shifting gears, we've, you know, hinted at Kibo, but shifting gears to that, more recently, you were the CEO of Kibo. And for those listening, Kibo was an online university that provided accredited computer science degree to African students. And I was privileged to serve at the company, and I worked alongside Akbar a lot. So Akbar, tell us, why did you start Kibo? What problem did you feel it needed to solve?
Yeah, so the problems that Kibo was really trying to solve was improving the quality of higher education on the continent. So Africa's higher education sector suffers from two challenges. One is like a lack of capacity, meaning there are more people who want to go to university than there are university spots. In places like Nigeria, where I'm from, every year, like a million students or so take JAM and don't get a spot in university. And then the, I think, even bigger problem is quality, right? So you have a lot of university grads on the continent who come out and they are unemployed and also unemployable. And I experienced this personally when trying to hire. It's like people who are coming out of university, but just did not have the skills needed. And prior to starting Kibo, I always worked in technology companies. I worked at Google right before. And so I had this ambition for, you know, I think that young people in Nigeria and Kenya have the potential to be great software engineers and to build some world-class companies. But I think the thing that is really impeding us and continues to impede us is that we have a lot of potential, like a lot of potential talent, but I don't actually think we have a lot of high quality talent. And there's a lot of reasons that is, but I lay a big part of the failure at our education system. So the idea with Kibo, or the problem we were trying to solve, is like, can we provide a world-class computer science education to young Africans without them having to leave the continent, which is what people typically do. And, you know, we know that going abroad is not available for the overwhelming majority of the population. So that's what we were trying to do, is just really solve the problem of like low quality higher education.
You've talked a lot about, and more of us who have worked with you have heard the word like world class, which was also a common saying at Kibo. What does being world class mean to you? And why do you think it's important, you know, for Africans to strive towards that?
Being world class means being able to keep up with the best people in the world in whatever domain that you're in. And I think it's important for Africans to strive towards that because our competition is the whole world. So if I today want to go out and hire a marketer, or I want to hire a virtual assistant, I'm not just going to look around and say, who's in New York or who's in Atlanta? You know, I can hire somebody in the Philippines. I can hire somebody in India. I can hire someone in Kenya. And I think the world is increasingly becoming that way. And so if you want opportunities for your people have to be the best. And I think that there was a period where you could get by being the cheapest talent, right? Where it's like, okay, fine, you're not very good, but it's very inexpensive to hire you, so I'll hire you. With some of the things that we're seeing in technology and the automation of the lowest rung of work, that's becoming less and less possible, right? It's like, well, the tech is just going to do the low-skilled stuff now anyway. And no matter how cheap you are as a person, you're not going to be as cheap as Claude. So now I think it's even more important if you want to create opportunity for yourself to not just be looking around and thinking, oh, this is how good the bar is. Like, the bar has to be the best in the world. And in a place like Nigeria that I know well, it's like our bar is really low for all sorts of things, not just education, right? It's like we manage it like that. So we're just managing all sorts of nonsense in our culture. And like, we have to get to the point, right, we're not just looking around and be like, oh, I mean, Shibi, this is better than what they do in Lagos. It's like, doesn't matter, right? We need to think about like, what are the best people in the world doing and how can we be among them?
I laughed at this question because I had like this manage it like that question right after this.
You already know my pet peeves, Emmy, so it's going to come out. If you talk to me about these things, I'm like a broken record. I just repeat myself. Nobody's listening, but I'm still repeating it.
Curious to hear if there are any stories in there around where, you know, someone has told you to like manage it like that, or you've gotten the impression that people want you to manage things like that. And why do you think that's not great for our work and frankly, our society at large?
Yeah, I mean, what stories? I mean, who has spent time in Nigeria and hasn't been told that, right? Where it's like, I hired you to lay tiles in my house and you did them crooked when it could be straight. But you're like, well, it's finished. Just manage it. And like, no, I'm not going to manage it because it's not good. So I think that just in general, there's a lot of things that are challenging for us in Nigeria. But I would say that culture of mediocrity is like it's a real problem. And it's, you know, sometimes it's funny, but often it's not funny because in general, you are only going to aspire to what you can see and what's expected of you. And you know, one of the things I'm really proud of at Kibo is that like we had like a really good team, like a good workforce, but our students were also pushed really far, you know, and because of that, not everybody made it, right? Like not everybody was able to stay on the team. Not everybody was made to stay able to stay in the institution. And we weren't trying, you know, I'm never trying to push people out because I think everybody has infinite potential, right? But what I'm looking for are people who, to me, it doesn't matter what you can do when you get there. It matters like your willingness to push yourself to grow, and then your willingness to believe in excellence. And so I have, I think sometimes people, we can get more into this, like sometimes people just don't believe in excellence. Like the manage it like that phenomenon has like really seeped into their brain. But I think it's so important to us to get to your question. Good enough is not good enough, right? And yes, sometimes it drives you nuts because you're constantly trying to get better. And so we do have to learn to like moderate ourselves like psychologically because it can get, but you know, that's not our problem in Nigeria. Our problem is not that we're overstriving for excellence, trust me. So we don't need to worry about that. That's like, that would be a nice problem to have. Like, I think our problem in general is that we're just not doing things as well as they could be. And we see it in all sorts of small failures. You know, I was just reading some news article about this atrocious thing that happened with GM, which is like the exam people take to go to university. And the leader gave a statement, like a sort of press statement that was so, to me, it just lacked any ability to take personal responsibility. And I'm like, in a society that works, this guy would quit or he would be fired, you know, even if it wasn't his fault. It's just like part of striving for excellence is being like, oh, I'm in charge of this organization and something like this happens, then I'm not doing a good job. And so I think until we expect excellence and instead everybody's like, oh, well, you know, I forget what he said, like man plans, but God, you know, whatever. I can't even remember the phrase
Man proposes, but God disposes. I think that's the opening.
Something like that. Just totally, like, unbelievable, so stupid. And any, you know, like, thankfully, you know, I feel very fortunate to have been raised by two very strong Christians. And one of the phrases my dad always says is that, like, God will always do his own part. The question is, will Okwayemi do her own part, right? And I think that's the philosophy that we need to have, which is like, yes, of course, like we don't control everything or many things, but actually you control a lot. You have a lot of agency. So you go and you do your own part, right? And do your own part excellently. And then, you know, watch what God will do. But I think until we change our mindsets to that, like, oh yeah, we can be excellent. I can do the, even in the midst of a system that's flawed, I'm going to try to be excellent. If we had enough people adopting that mindset, you would start to see a lot of things changing.
Totally agree. And in the, you know, still in the conversation around education and what it could potentially look like, so what do you hope, you know, education for Nigerians or Africans more broadly could look like? And maybe a way to think about this question might be for folks who are building, who want to continue to build for education, who are building for education out there right now, if things were perfect, what would you hope that, you know, they focus on, or what do you hope that would...
Gosh, it's a really difficult question, Emmy, and we would need like a 10-hour podcast for me to answer this question. So I won't really be able to answer it, but I will say a few things that I think are relevant. One is, in an ideal world, we would have a much greater focus on quality early education for everybody. Even though I worked in higher ed, I actually think like our huge problem is that we've got millions and millions of young African, you know, we are as a region in a baby boom, and there's just like more and more of us. And our education system isn't keeping up. So how do we do, you know, 0 to 12 years old education that's really, really high quality, really strong, gives people like the mental faculties to prepare for an uncertain future? We're not doing that now. So I think in an ideal, quote unquote, perfect world, we would, and that job is really a job of government and families, right? But in a perfect world, we would have much more focus on reimagining primary and secondary schooling to create like a really strong foundation for young Africans. Outside of primary and secondary schooling, in higher education, I said that there's not enough higher education seats, but I actually, the thing that I would go after in higher education is just much more quality. I don't think the quantity problem is worth solving without the quality problem, because what I'm starting to see is people are going to create, you know, as the regulations are loosening up, and now even in a place like Nigeria, it's easier to do like online institutions, open institutions. I think we're going to see the market get flooded with really crappy institutions, and that doesn't help us. So yes, everybody will have the degree credential. Like, the credential doesn't matter in this world, right? Like, what matters is how good you are and what you can do. So I think in like an ideal world, we would have a focus on incentivizing really, really high quality institutions, if nothing else, just to serve as models for what's possible in our own context, right? Like super strong, high quality institutions that are local to us, right? Like money leaves Nigeria every year, right? To send young people to really everywhere in the world. It used to just be like the UK, US, Canada, but now it's Asia, it's like Eastern Europe, it's Latam. Like, we are just giving money away, right? And I think it's fine. Like, those people ought to go where they can increase their potential. But what it means is like, we're not developing like the capacity locally. We're not developing like the belief that we too can do things that are strong. And so again, I think in higher education, in an ideal world, our focus would be on really strong quality. I was just having a conversation recently about IIT, which is a education group of institutions that the Indian government launched like in the 60s and 70s, and I think it is very directly responsible for a lot of the progress India has made in terms of becoming, for a long period at least, like the sort of outsourcing capital of the world for software. So I think we have to invest in just quality in higher ed, and then in K-12, invest in, again, quality, but also actually there, like, really quantity to get every child into school.
So shifting gears back to product, you've been work this time. You've been pretty vocal about your appreciation for writing. In the tweets that I found from your Twitter account from years ago, and I think might still be relevant now, you had shared good writing is underappreciated and sadly devalued in education's focus on STEM. Learning to write well has benefited me as much in my tech career as my math major has. First of all, do you think this is still relevant now? And, you know, are there examples you can share of how, you know, writing has been beneficial to you, especially in your work as a PM?
Yes. So it is still relevant. I think I probably tweeted that like a decade ago. I haven't been on X in years at this point. So I know it's an old tweet, or I guess we're still calling them tweets. I don't know, whatever. So yes, I 100%. I think that the ability to write well is more important than ever, which might seem unintuitive when Claude writes so well and ChatGPT and Grammarly, but good writing is a proxy for good thinking, right? And that's really what we're talking about when you write is like how you think. And so, you know, Amazon kind of had like a thing that they were famous for a while, where you would have to write these memos and they were only 6 pages and everybody would read the memos. And I like that model because writing well requires thinking well. You know, I was pitching a friend on an idea I had, and I like to write sort of 2 pagers when I have an idea, but it's very hard to write 2 pages. Like usually I start out with 6, like everything is disorganized. It doesn't really make sense. And it is the process of rewriting it to be like, let me distill this down to its essence, right? So the writing process is actually a thinking process, right? And people who can write really clearly, it's usually directly related to how well they think. Now, it is interesting today for me, just as in a role of like, say, hiring or evaluating people, I know that oftentimes people are not, like, they're not doing the writing themselves, right? Like they're using AI to do it. So I'm still thinking through what the implications of those are for how you evaluate people. But it is still true though, that good writing is really valuable in your career. And even I, you know, we don't have to get into this. Like I certainly use, like I love using Claude, and Claude is part of my writing process, but I still really try to write a lot and think through writing. And then in terms of my PM career, it's just like a big part of what you're doing as a PM is clarity, right? You're taking an organization where there are lots of individuals, meaning like kind of lots of different ideas about like what we're doing. And you're trying to get everybody to be on the same page and to be clear about what we're doing and why and how we'll know if it's working. I don't think that there is a more efficient way to do that still than really, really concise, clear writing of like, this is the PRD, like this is our product vision. Because, you know, I love speaking, and I think one of the things I'm thinking about is what I believe will become like an increased relevance of oral communication in a post-AI world. So the ability to speak well is also critical, and I think will become more critical. But you can have really eloquent speech that doesn't actually say anything, that's devoid of meaning, because speaking also has this thing of like, it's a little bit about the person and like how they're moving and how they make me feel. Like I'm sure I'm not the only person who's watched like a great TED talk or a great speech, and then 2 minutes later it's like, what was that about? Like I have like nothing, like I don't know, you know? And so writing, I think, kind of forces you, because it's asynchronous, right? Like you write it and then other people approach it away from you. It's very obvious whether or not it's clear and it holds together. In a way that speech, you can kind of fake it a little bit by using other things beyond the words.
I really, really appreciate that. And this reminded me a lot about my early days at Kibo, where I would see multiple, and obviously this ties to the comment around, you know, talent quality and being able to, you know, at least get to a certain level, you know, when you get to the workplace. But this reminded me a lot about my early days at Kibo. You know, I would wake up and I would see lots of comments, lots of suggestions, like, Emmy, what are you saying here? Like, what exactly are you trying to pass here? So I've definitely now, at least I now appreciate a lot of that training, because a lot of my work right now involves writing, and being able to do that clearly and you're sending that to busy professionals is, you know, a big ask. And so being able to do that well, I think, is super, super important, especially in your work as a PM. So you've done a lot of hiring. right? So with how things are right now, with the hiring freezes, with the layoffs, at the time of recording, Microsoft just laid off 6,000 people. So with all the hiring freezes, with AI right now, if you're hiring a PM today, what would you say would be some immediate green flags? And what would you say would be some red flag? Maybe let's take one green flag and one red flag.
Sure. So I don't think that the things that matter have changed that much in terms of what makes a really good PM. I think the big green flag is somebody who is high agency. And so how do you demonstrate high agency? If you're coming and you're saying, okay, I want to be a PM, I think it's a really interesting role, but you've never built anything, how do I know that you have agency, right? Or today in the world where you've got all of these new tools that are changing how software engineering happens, if you're a PM and you've never used any of these tools, or you're not like sort of trying to stay informed about what's out there, then you're not really showing that you have like high agency or high initiative. So I think a green flag would be someone who demonstrates like really high agency, and that they've like gone and they've built a bunch of things, even if those things didn't go anywhere, but they're a builder. I think a red flag, on the other hand, would be somebody who isn't really even trying to keep up with what's changing in the industry. So if I'm talking to you and it's like, oh no, I've never used Replit, I've never used Lovable, I've never used V0, I don't even really know what these things are, I'd be like, bruh, what? Like, just, they're,
what
you
have
know,
you been
like,
doing?
What have you been doing? Yeah, like, are you like laying under a rock and expecting a PM job? So yes, I think not attempting to stay up to date is a big red flag.
And I had this question a lot for you during my time at Kibo, but you know, how might someone who is sort of non-technical be able to set themselves apart, or be able to land, you know, PM jobs right now? Or do you think, you know, AI is now acting as a kind of leveler for, you know, technical, non-technical folks, and that doesn't matter that much?
So no, I don't think that AI is acting as a complete leveler. So what I believe AI, some of the sort of vibe coding tools let you do today is prototype. So if you are somebody who has high agency and you're like, I can just build something with AI and then I can launch it and see how many users I get, I think that's really great, you know, because 10 years ago, when I would be trying to talk to people who are trying to break into PM and weren't technical, the challenge is like, people don't really want to hire a new PM. Like, it's very hard. You know, the big companies used to do it. They're shrinking, but it's just hard to have like a brand new PM. And so the trick, and what I used to tell people, is, okay, try to see if you can like build something on the side, right? Hire a software developer, find a friend who's a developer, try to launch something on the side. The good news is like, that's so much easier to do now, right? You don't even need to hire a developer because you can do it yourself. So AI is leveling that part of the playing field for prototyping, but AI is not changing the need for a PM to understand technology, right? So if you think about, if you're going to try to be a product manager and I'm interviewing you and I give you an app and I'm like, just explain to me like the different components of this app. Like, if you cannot conceptualize like, this is what a database is, or this is what an API is, like this is how, just like conceptually how things work, that's still really important, right? You're not going to be the engineer, you're not doing the systems design, but you've got to have a good conceptual understanding of software and technology. And then even today, I would say like a good conceptual understanding of like how, because everybody's trying to integrate AI into their products, of how AI products work, and some concepts that are more related to like AI product build specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe AI can help you learn those things faster than back in the day. So that it is changing the playing field in that way.
Yeah. So I guess like now you technically will need less folks to at least get off the ground, because, you know, there are tools that will enable you to do that, but still being able to have really good understanding around like technology and how, you know, technology comes together to make your thing work is critical. As someone who has spent time, you know, building products and has worked as PM for years, how would you simply and exhaustively define product management?
So I think product management is the process of building solutions that address customers' needs and meet business goals.
Thank you very much for that definition. I mentioned I have questions from ex-colleagues. Fumi has a question for you. How do you think Batman can save more lives in Gotham?
I don't know how many lives Batman is saving in Gotham as we speak, so it's hard. I'll do one that's like cheeky. I think Batman should be spending more time educating people, and if Gotham has a more educated workforce, there'll be less need for lives to be saved.
Good answer. I asked that question to get a laugh out, but thank you for that answer. Cheryl asks, what are the skills that people should prioritize for work today? And yeah, that's very broad, but maybe you can think about it in like that entry-level new grad or new employee level. What do you think are some skills that people should prioritize for work?
Yeah, I don't know if these are skills or mindsets, because I think they're like lots of skills, but I think one mindset, again, is like agency, like be the type of person who gets things done. Don't be passive. Like, you have a lot of agency, use it. So I want to work with people who I know will try to get things done. The other thing is like be the kind of person who does what they say they'll do. So often when you're hiring someone really early in their career, again, I don't necessarily expect them to have a ton of skill, but I expect them to be conscientious, right? Like show up, do the thing. And gosh, like so many people like lack just the ability to be conscientious. So I would say, yeah, conscientiousness, agency. And then the third one are just strong communication skills, right? Like really work on how you speak, really work on how you write, even if you're going to be a software engineer. So to be clear, those three things I think are critical no matter what you type of job that you're looking for. And communication, I can't overemphasizing us as a practical skill, especially for those of us who are in Nigeria and in Africa, because we don't have enough jobs locally, right? And so you are going to, I think, to really maximize your potential, there's a strong likelihood that you're going to be looking to work with people who aren't local. You might be looking to get a remote job. And the communication thing is the thing that knocks people out all the time. So, you know, agency, conscientiousness, mindset, communication, skill.
Thank you. Thank you. No, thank you very much for that. I'm running into the lightning round right now. So quick answers. Is there a cool tool, work tool specifically, that you've used recently that have just blown your mind away in terms of how useful it is?
I'm currently just like my mind is being blown by all the vibe coding tools. So Replit is one. So probably Replit.
Is there a lesson you've learned really late in your career as a PM that new PMs should be on the lookout for?
It's your job to do anything that isn't being done. So you might think you're a PM, but actually you can be a marketer. You can be a customer service rep. Like just do anything that's not being done.
That's a good way to think about it. Is there a book, podcast, or resource you follow that continues to, you know, help you or has helped you refine your craft over time and other folks can, you know, learn from?
Like from a professional perspective?
Yeah. So book, podcast, resource.
I mean, this one's probably a pretty common one, but I think a lot of PMs like, and I continue to learn a lot from like Lenny's podcast, like really good podcast for people who want to build products.
Thank you so much. How might we be useful to you? Is there anything you're working on that we should be on the lookout for? Check out?
Not right now, to be honest. You know, I think I'm doing a lot of consulting. I'm in like the early stages of a bunch of things, so nothing that's like shared to the world right now. So, but just keep learning and keep being curious.
All right. Thank you so much, Akpe. That's it, folks. I hope you found this episode useful. Thanks for tuning in and staying till the end. Let me know what you think in the comments and who you'd like to see next on the pod. Don't forget to like, follow, or subscribe wherever you're listening from, and share with someone in your network who might find this useful. That's all for now. I'm Emmy, and I'll see you next time.